The most important thing is observation. The second one is experimentation. The third one is data collection and recording and analysis now. And the fourth and extremely important is the communication of that information to everybody, to other scientists and the public. Everybody can do and should do science. You don't have to have a PhD or a master's or a BSc. You can work, do science in the kitchen. You can do science in the garden. If you're a good observer and if you take good records and you repeat your observations, you are a scientist. It's as simple as that. Don't be afraid to ask good questions. So what we are doing, essentially, we're gathering data to find evidence as to how it is. That's what it's all about. If you make a hypothesis, you make a prediction based on past observations, you say, I think it might be like this. And then you have to bring evidence in form of data. It's not good enough to put on a white coat and say it is this way. That's not good enough. You have to bring the data and convince others as to what the real direction of nature is. It's not good enough to apply just insight, common sense, intuition, or even logic sometimes. That can be misleading too. These words I just used, they might help you to sort of formulate a good question, but you must go further. You must bring evidence and data to verify and to substantiate your claim. And that's essentially science in a nutshell. Science splits up into basic science, the basic, really difficult question. We're talking about nuclear science and astronomy and all these heavy things. The essence of physical and chemical reactions and so on, and biological processes. But then there's also the application of that information to the needs we have to run our lives. And that is called applied science. Frequently, comparison of method. Is this better than that? And how do I use what the basic scientist came up with? How can I apply that to a certain progress for society and so on? And then there's this funny word, technology. Technology. You and I know what technology is, the camera, this thing, it's all technology. But technology is based in science. You can't have good technology without science. And then once you have the technology in place, that helps you to do even better science. And a good example is when the first telescope was invented, 1609. Well, that was technology, but of course, science was needed first to produce the lenses. So you have this telescope, and now, with this technology, now you can really explore and now can do good science. So the technology and science essentially go hand in hand. Let me give you a quick insight into the history of science, and I find this fascinating. I didn't realize it until recently how young the history of science is. The Greeks played around with understanding nature. Aristotle and all his companions in those days, they were looking at the nature and saying, well, I wonder how this works and I wonder how this works. And they sort of came up with answers the way they think it should work, the way they would like it to be. And that's sort of referred to as mystical science. And that prevailed for a long time. And then came the Dark Ages. And I gather, I don't know too much about them, but I gather they must have been really dark because they didn't want to know anything. And that came from about 400 to 900 A.D., 5 centuries of nothing. And then they came the Middle Ages, and I gather, I don't know if that was any better. There was an awful lot of warfare going on, and they just seemed to be all doing just fight each other all the time, probably the same as now. And that lasted from 900 to 1400, another 500 years. So there was really no progress. Recently I learned that the figure zero came to Western world only around 1200. And it took quite a few more centuries before it was functionally applied as a number. Now, a very important change came Gutenberg, the guy who invented the mobile, the movable type. That was in 1450. In 1450, and that was really most timely for him to do this because thereafter, all sorts of scientific investigations took place, and they really needed to publish this stuff. So it was most fortuitous that this guy started things going, because before that, it's amazing. Before that, if you wanted a copy of a document or a book or a Bible or whatever, you had to give it to somebody and say, please copy this for me. I give you so many dollars or whatever, you know. And then he would sit down for 2 or 3 years and copy it and give you the copy. And that's how it was. It was just amazing. The symbols of positive and negative didn't come into functionality until 1450. I mean, that's less than 500 years ago. That's incredible. That was just yesterday. The first scientists, early 1600, William Gilbert published a book, now that he could with the Gutenberg's technology, on magnetism. And the reason he's considered the first scientist is because he applied what I told you about observation, experimentation, data collection, and recording. He applied those meticulously. And it's amazing, these, you know, the human innovation that, well, he decided, I'm going to do it right. Well, no one told him what right was. But he did. And so did Galileo, the fellow who he didn't invent the first telescope, but he produced one of the better ones. So these guys, these two are considered the first scientists because they applied the principle of science. So that was in the early 1600s, 400 years ago only. And then, talking about observation, there was a guy called, a Danish guy, Tycho Brahe. Well, this guy, without a telescope, they hadn't been invented, he studied and recorded the position of 1,000 stars. And that's all he did all his life, essentially. That was most of his life's effort. And then Kepler came along thereafter, who's in fact his co-worker later in life, and he mathematically explained why these stars and why the planets should be where they were. And then in 1687, Isaac Newton came along, and he explained mathematically why these observations were in fact true. So this is a classical example of science going step by step by step forward. Newton wrote the book, The Mathematical Principle of Natural Philosophy, and that really sparked a revolution in Europe because everybody thought, oh, God, I think there's money to be made here. And they went into technology big ways. They had these science cafes, something like this, and they would talk to each other about this and that and about the science, the information, the technology. And by golly, yeah, they produced all sorts of machines that would now do man's work. And it was called the Industrial Revolution. That was the beginning of it. And this book was written just recently, The Rise of Public Science. That's what that period was, 1660, 750, Newtonian Britain. Magnificent summary of that period of time. The microscope came 1650. And Robert Hooke, just a few years later, wrote a book about the details of minute life, the micrography. James Watt and his steam engine was 1769. And then there was John Harrison. Now, that guy was awesome. He was a watchmaker. And at that time, the navies and the sailors didn't know where they were when they traveled across the ocean. They really didn't know where they thought they were, but they never were sure. They didn't know longitude, how to measure it. And he insisted it can be done with time. I won't go into the detail as to why. And he even was smarter than Newton, because he wanted to do with the moon. But this guy sat down and he finally made a watch that was durable on the oceans. And he spent his entire life producing these watches. This man was amazing. Oxygen was discovered in 1775. Chemistry, the first chemistry book, Elements of Chemistry, 1789. I mean, 220 years ago, that's incredible. Theory of the Earth, Geology, 1795. Charles Darwin, 1859, 150 years to 160 years ago, just yesterday. Electricity was invented in 1831, the dynamo, and now we have windmills all over the place. That's the theory of Faraday's and windmills production. Mendel, talk about observation. He was the father of genetics, of inheritance. He spent most of his life tending to his pea plants, thousands of them, individually. And he pollinated them himself, not by bees or by wind. And he took records, meticulous records. And he learned that there is something in these peas that is transmitted from one to the next, the heredity. Just amazing patience and desire to know. Einstein, of course, his famous formula. I mean, E equals mc squared, and C stands for the light, speed of light. So this is energy. This must be really big. Mass times 300,000 times 300,000. Oh, now that's pretty big. But this is all still sound information. The structure of DNA, and I gave you the copy of the famous paper. It's a one-pager, highly quoted paper. I don't expect you to memorize it or understand it. I don't understand most of it myself. But it is a perfect example of the recording of science. And these guys did not do it themselves. This was step-by-step information which they utilized and said, well, therefore it must be this way. And it has stood the test of time. And that's what a good scientific paper is. If it stands the test of time, because lots of people try to knock it down, that's what science is all about. Once you publish something, they are just the hawks out there. They're trying to prove you wrong. That's what it's all about. And then plate tectonics came along in 1966 when we found out that continents actually move. And then finally in 1990, we found out that the elements we have in our bodies are also found up in the universe. So that's just a brief history of the excitement of this subject and the type of people required to figure this out, step by step by step. Now, what is a scientist? The ideal scientists. There are also bad ones, and there are some crooked ones, but there are ideal scientists, and they pursue knowledge, new knowledge. They produce that, but they sell nothing. That's maybe the only difference with all the other professions. They must be willing to embark on a 10-year study of basic degree, master's program, and PhD. Now, here's an example of a master's thesis at the University of Lethbridge. 2 years or 3 years that it takes to produce this book on science. Then you do the master's thesis, and then you do another one like this to get your PhD. Because with the PhD, you're supposed to bring a little bit more knowledge than with a master's thesis. Then you're ready to do your own investigations. So the commitment is horrendous. You have to be passionate about discovering the truth. Patient, tolerant, stubborn, curious, competitive, emotionally strong. Because I told you, when you publish something, the first thing they want to do is knock you down. Persistence, selfish in time. You have to be lucky. You have to be artful in your creativity. And have a money supply, especially nowadays. The equipment you need to do your investigations, you need lots of money. And that's where you come in. Are you ready to give science all that money they demand? And above all, they have to have the desire to be most part of the greatest story ever told, the history of life and matter. It's an amazing story. But in the next 5 minutes or so, I want to give you the highlight of the scientific endeavor, and it is so important. It is so important. That's communication. And the extent of this communication is phenomenal. The number of journals that are out there is in the thousands. For example, the database for medical issues is something like 5,000 journals. It includes veterinary and so on. It's called PubMed. You might note that. It's PubMed, PubMed. And you go on the internet, and there it is. You can put in your keywords like arthritis or whatever you have, and you get all these summaries of and the titles and the abstracts of these articles, and some of them even the total articles. 5,000 journals. And I show you an example of just one of these journals, or some of these journals. This one here is Nature. This is published in Britain, and it's sort of a general article in science. They take most subject matter. But in order to get in here, you have to be really good. Something like 90% of the journal, of the articles which are submitted to this journal are rejected. They're not good enough. Okay. Here's an example of the Canadian Veterinary Journal, Veterinary Research. And then here's an example of Cell. This is another one, high profile, very, very difficult to get your articles into this journal. There's an article in here about the connection of the nervous connection to the muscle tissue, and the number of references cited in this article, 260. Okay? And here's emerging infectious diseases. So the titles of these articles, you know, there's journals on arthritis and on vision, they are cover the whole gamut of science, physics, chemistry, biology, agriculture, you name it, thousands of them. It's a huge industry, a huge industry. Very importantly, how do you write one of these articles? Because that's the bread and butter of scientists. If it's not recorded, if it's not communicated, you haven't done it. And I had a colleague, he worked essentially 12 hours a day, every day, Sunday, Christmas Day, all the time. He published nothing. He did no work, as far as I'm concerned, as far as you're concerned. All that stuff just evaporated, was burned or disappeared. So if you don't publish, you haven't done any work. So these articles are, they have a title, and the authors are mentioned, senior author. It's prestigious to be the senior author, and then junior authors. And nowadays, many of these articles are written by a whole slew of authors because there are so many people needed to produce these papers now, and you need so many resources to produce them. And then you have the introduction, usually, where you tell everybody as to why you're doing it and where the deficiencies of past information are, and you try to provide more information. Then the material and methods, you describe what process and what method you're going to use to do your study. And all of this has to be described in such a manner that anybody, essentially, if that's what they really want to do, could reproduce this information. It has to be precisely recorded as to what they did and how they did it and where they got them and cite references where they get the information from. And then in the discussion comes where you relate this and summarize it as to how it relates to the issue you introduced in the introduction. And the most important thing then, your list of references. The list of references as to what is the past observations and the past material you utilized to produce your own work. So you produce these papers and you submit them to the review committee, and it comes back to you, make these changes, and then it goes to the journal, and the editor sends it to two workers who you do not know. And they sit down and they read the paper, and they either reject it, or they accept it as is, or they say accept with minor revision, or accept with major revision. So when this paper, when the letter comes back from the editor, you're shaking. You got maybe years' work, or 5 years, or 10 years of work in this, and you don't know whether this will be rejected or accepted. And this is it's tough. It's a tough world. It's a competitive world, and it's very, very exciting. So, and that's what's called peer review. Peer review. Now remember, that's very important. Peer review, because if you're studying your garden, if you don't have it reviewed by somebody else, it's not very solid evidence. You have to have it reviewed by somebody else who's knowledgeable about the subject matter and who is honest enough to give you the true opinion. Never mind emotions, and maybe he doesn't like that. That is totally irrelevant. The only thing that matters is to make this correct, to make this correct. And then, of course, you also mentioned the acknowledgments as to help you, who helped you, where the money came from, the granting, and so on. So that's the last thing I want to, the last point I want to make is that because of this system of peer review, of course, the people who write these articles, the scientists, they're humans. They make mistakes, okay? The machines they use, they make mistakes. So repetition is very, very important. And the system is self-correcting. Now, supposing this paper here is faulty, others will read it, and they will try to reproduce this with a different slant and so on. They say, I can't do it. It can't be done. So with eventually, 2 or 3 years, 10 years or so, we will find out that this paper is faulty in some form or other. So the system is very, very sound in self-correction. It may take time. Now, there have been examples where scientists have been fraudulent, intentionally faking graphs or data, and they will be found out. And they are always being found out because the work cannot be repeated. And then they will have to they have to be shamefully hide themselves in a corner somewhere. So it is an amazing process, and that's what I want to emphasize, of seeking the truth and checking each other out.